WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth,
very
Charlie
good.
Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us, sir. How are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome to another Monday Night Talk, a warm Monday Night Talk. I'm going to say that our temperatures have reached about 95 degrees here at Broadcast House. So we got a great show for you. I promise when you get done hearing this program this evening, you'll want to tune in and check out the podcast. We'll first, of course, introduce... I'm going to have multiple co-hosts this evening. Kind of a cool concept when you have kind of a roundtable thing going on. And one of my co-hosts is actually going to be a co-host and a guest. So he'll take off the co-host hat and kind of just go into guest mode. And that is none other than State Representative Dave DeCoste.
How are you doing, Kevin?
We're doing pretty good.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I sent you a text. It was good to have you respond back. And you sent me like a bunch of bills. So we're going to talk about a number of things. And you're going to stay on for additional conversation. One, in regards to a bill that's been put forth by a group of residents up in the Tewksbury area who want to ban the use of Native American mascots in Massachusetts. That is, if you are the Hanover Indians, we'll have to figure out another name for that Hanover team, because if the bill passes and becomes law, that can no longer happen. So we're going to talk about that. And there are a couple other things that you have on the table that we're going to talk about that I'm looking forward to as well. And then we also have Matt Nelson. I like to call him Matty Ice. Matty Ice. Matt is a production guy. And not only does he do fine production work for Brockton Community Access, he has done some work for NESN. So we're welcoming Matt. Matt's always a passionate guy, and one of his assignments a couple of weeks ago, I said to him, I says, Matt, I would like to have you on, but we have to, I don't want to call it hazing, but I had to test him. So Matt, I need you to book a guest. He goes, who? I threw out the name. He goes, okay, let me see what I can do. It probably took him 24 to 48 hours to get back to me and say, done. I go, you're kidding. Nope, no problem. Who's that guest? None other than NESN's Jack Edwards, who is the voice of the Boston Bruins. And anybody who loves hockey and who loves a animated announcer, that's what you get in Jack Edwards. He's almost like the Johnny Most of hockey. Would that be accurate, Dave?
I'd say so.
Yeah. Yeah. When he gets in, there's nobody who could drop the cliches and who can, go from 0 to 60 when it comes to talking hockey than Jack. And we'll give you more of the lineup in just a moment, and we'll come back and chat with Representative DeCoste.
A Dad's Story by Brennan Smokeshaw. I'm like 12 years old. Me and my father are trolling for bass down a little sandy pond in Plymouth. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, my rod bends in half. I'm reeling. My dad says, Jeffrey, give me the rod. And I'm like, no, Dad, I got this. I'm reeling and I'm reeling and I'm reeling. Dad's like, give me the rod, Jeffrey. I'm like, no, I got this, Dad. Jeffrey, give me the rod, he says. As he's saying it, this huge whopper of a bass comes jumping up out of the water. It's huge. The line snaps. My father hits the roof. Jeffrey! Ooh. Needless to say, we were done fishing after that. I'll tell you something, my dad has never caught a fish that big, and he probably never will. I'm sorry, Dad. I love you. Happy Father's Day from Brennan's Smoke Shop. Brennan's Smoke Shop, keeping fathers happy since 1993.
Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to the program. Thank you for keeping your radio dial set here to 959WATD. Before the break, we were telling you who some of our guests will be. Also, gentleman who we had some kind of an issue because of what was happening in England. He became so popular that he was on different TV and radio stations. He is confirmed tonight. Ryan Morrow, the national security analyst, will be joining us to talk a little bit about in the wake of those two attacks in England, in the wake of the attacks we've seen in Paris, that we saw in Germany. The list is long. And my question that I posed to him before we let him go and hung up the phone and promised that we would hear from him this week is, what is being done in this country to make sure that similar attacks will not happen? Because it's not necessarily just someone with a bomb. It might be just a handful of thugs with knives, or, you know, maybe an 18-wheel truck that are going to drive it into a large crowd just to make a point. So we'll speak with Ryan about that. And at 6:40, so Ryan is at 7 o'clock. At 6:40, we're expecting to hear from Kerry J. Byrne. We know Kerry from coldhardfootballfacts.com. Also know him from the Boston Herald. And I think he has a firm that he does in regards to hospitalities. We'll get that. We'll pull that information out of him when we see him this evening. He'll be here, as will Claudia Foxtree. She is a professional educator, and she leads the conversation when it comes to Native American identity, culture, and history. So we're getting folks who have opinions on both sides of the possible ban of the use of Native American mascots when it comes to public schools. So that's what we have on tap for you this evening. And joining me first up, as I teased prior to traffic, is State Representative Dave DeCoste. Representative?
Kevin, thank you for having me.
Where do we start? You have things here for sanctuary cities. From what I'm understanding, we got a little bit of an issue in regards to the pension fund?
Yeah.
Where do you want to start?
Well, I tell you what, the phone was ringing off the hook this week and last regarding mascots and sanctuary city builds. They were actually, for the first time in over a year, I was not that, you know, typically I have my office hours Friday and start in Norwell, midday in Hanover, and the afternoon I'm in Rockland. I was not there. My aide was. It's kind of unusual. But we actually had so many constituents that wanted to be escorted up for testimony. And I also, by the way, got to have my first ceremony. I had a constituent from Hanover, and she was awarded a gold level medal for the Girl Scouts, which is really unusual, and it's terrific. Her brother, by the way, was an Eagle Scout.
Her name?
Scouting Fanny family.
Okay.
But if I was a better politician, I could do that right off the top of my head.
Yep,
but
yep.
With the two of them, and as a matter of fact, Saturday we had another Eagle Scout.
What was that like for you, though, to be able to have that happen?
Both of them are great. You know, that's one of the nice things to any type of Scout award ceremony. Is terrific, and I'll tell you, all three scouting organizations in Lowell, Rockland, and especially Hanover, are producing a great number of Eagle Scouts, and it's terrific to be able to go to those. And I haven't missed one of the Eagle ceremonies yet, which was terrific. But back to the mascots, the phone was ringing off the hook, especially from Hanover, and they were concerned about legislation. And I understand the concern from there's Senator Lee Italian who had filed that legislation, but there's a great deal of opposition. No one spoke in favor of it. And I think in general, my philosophy on naming mascots is that the local communities are quite capable of naming mascots and don't need any help from bureaucrats at Beacon Hill to do it. And I don't think that legislation will ever see the light of day, but as of now, it's still being looked at.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I know there was a hearing last week on this. I believe that the senator, Lee Italian, actually was just a presenter, because it was brought forth. It was a citizen's petition.
And they
brought it to her to present it, so to speak. They needed a presenter. She was willing to do so. So that's how that happened. From what I understand, it's a group that is looking to get some attention for this, and I'm looking forward to hearing both sides, whether it's constituents that you're hearing from who are saying, I don't know if I like this idea, why now, and also hear from somebody who is representing the side of something needs to be done because there's an issue with this, using these names and how it's being depicted. Whether it's not in the proper light for Native Americans and the culture. So I'm looking forward to hearing from both sides. Now, you mentioned something in some of the stuff that you sent me in regards to sanctuary cities.
Yes.
What's the conversation that you're hearing from people? I know that there's been bills filed. If you could kind of give us the Cliff's Notes version of those bills and what the purpose are of them are.
Sure. The Safe Communities Act, which is, there were several of them, but I'll talk to Bill S-1305, filed in both the House and the Senate, basically would limit the ability of local communities to work with federal authorities to return illegal immigrants, folks who are not here in the country, either they've come over the southern border or they overstayed their visa for whatever reason. It would limit the ability of our local law enforcement to interact with the federal law enforcement in returning these people over to Immigration and Customs for deportation.
Matt, do you have a question?
Yes, actually. So I happen to be from Brockton, and there was quite the uproar a few weeks ago, maybe about a month ago now, regarding kind of all of the Safe Communities Act bundled into my state representative, Michelle Dubois. So have you heard anything regarding what happened back in, I think it was April, and what the general feeling is on safe communities? Should it be left to the city level, or should it be a statewide issue?
I would say, first of all, and I represent Norwell, Hanover, and Rockland. And in those three communities, if they were put to a vote, there's no question in my mind that this effort would fail. I think there's a great deal of opposition to the general concept of sanctuary cities. It's interesting, during the testimony, I would say that the majority of people who came were actually immigrants themselves. And towards the end, there was, and I stayed until, it's well past 5 o'clock on Friday, and it's, by the way, Representative Hank Naughton did a terrific job riding herd as chairman. He was very fair, and he sat through and he made sure that everybody who wanted to testify was able to testify. But the testimony was largely towards the end from immigrants from all. There was a young lady from Mexico, a number of young ladies from, and they tended to be mostly women towards the end. There was a young lady from Brockton, a Haitian. She self-identified, and a number of folks from Asian communities, as I recall, from Winchester. And the short of it is, they all made the point, and I'll paraphrase, but they came, they incurred the cost, they did it correctly, and they don't see why anybody should be able to jump in line. And this law will assist those, aid and abet those who have broken our laws.
What kind of support is this? Now, I see that there's a House bill mm-hmm. and a Senate bill. Mm-hmm. House bill number 3269, and you have a Senate bill, which is 1305S. Mm-hmm. 1305. Are they similar in statute, or are there stark differences?
Well, we won't go through the nuances because then we'd really be here, and I'm not prepared to speak. But I think generally they both try to accomplish the same things. I will say I was very happy with the governor, Governor Baker has taken a strong stand against this, and he has basically delineated quite well the reasons why this is not a good bill from the standpoint of enforcing the law and public safety. I think it undermines public safety, and it's really tough from that standpoint to justify a vote for it. And I don't, if I had to bet one way or the other, I don't think this bill is going to be successful. Okay. I don't think it will come to a vote.
So it's something that will stand for us to kind of keep an eye on and see what ends up happening.
You're right.
Okay. While we have you here, one of the things that you passed along was something that was put forth. Looks like it's a piece. Massachusetts finances gets an F.
Yeah. This is a pet issue of mine, and it was while I was a selectman. But the bottom line is which, by the way, with the help of both Democrats, this is a bipartisan bill. Okay. The help of both Democrats and Republicans, there were laws passed causing the communities and the states to delineate their pension costs, and the two categories tend to be the pension itself, the pension proper, and also health care costs. And the bottom line is that, as you've heard me talk quite a bit before, is that the local communities and the state, they are not meeting their obligations to retirees and future retirees in terms of the funding necessary to accomplish paying pensions and health care for those folks who are going to rely on the system once they've worked and gone into the retirement systems. And that's true whether it be a local system, the state system, the county system. They're all underfunded to one degree or the other. It's simply a matter of you know, to the degree that they're underfunded. And I think that report speaks specifically to the MBTA, and they are dangerously underfunded, and we need to do something about that. And again, the governor, I think, is led, but it is an enormous problem.
If I'm reading the information correct here, it's saying at this particular time, the debt burden for retirees for every Massachusetts resident, and I don't know if this is correct information, but this is what's in the article, at this time equates to nearly $33,000 for every Massachusetts taxpayer.
Correct.
Which is actually a little bit more than $2,600. That was in 2015, and it seems as though that's a troubling set of statistics, if you ask me.
It's alarming. Now, some of that's a result of good things. People are living longer, and that's a good thing. But when people live longer, the requirements for health care and, of course, pensions get paid out longer, and that's a difficult. So you have to look at mortality tables that, you know, make the problem a little bit more difficult. But I think the bulk of the problem is that simply they haven't been paying what they should be paying at all levels, and the state is on the hook. What concerns me most of all is the pension liability for the MBTA, which I think absolutely should be met. We've made commitments to those people, the current and future, that those employees who rely on the system, but it's expensive. It's an expensive proposition.
What is the solution? Is there a solution? Is it a matter of making sure that whoever, you know, isn't it the treasurer, the state treasurer, who is the keeper of finances, or is it the individual municipalities or how they set it up?
That's a good question. When you look at the MBTA, it's basically MBTA Pension Board, and let's talk, for instance, simply about the state, because I am a state representative. They're doing okay. They're not doing as well as we would like, and we have to. The solution, to answer your question specifically, would be, number one, to increase the current funding, and maybe to look at putting the new employees under, and we have done this in many cases, under a less generous system. And that, unfortunately, produces a two-tier system where older people, folks who've been in the system a while, have a much better retirement with lower contribution rates. But if you went from town to town, you would find this quite a bit among both the teaching and non-teaching employees, school system and non-school system employees among all the towns. There's definitely the folks who got in under lower rates, and the folks who are paying more in their recent hires. It's funny, I just got done speaking to the Mass Teachers representatives at the Tink & Son, one of your sponsors
right,
here.
Right up the road. Yeah.
Right up the road.
Right up the road.
And we spoke to that problem quite a bit. And they realized there's a problem and that it's going to take some doing to get it fixed. But this is good, at least, that they are now required to acknowledge and calculate on an actuarially sound basis at least what a best estimate of the magnitude of the problem. 5 years ago, that wasn't the case. So we're making progress, at least in terms of transparency.
Okay. We just got a couple of minutes left in regards with this particular segment. I know that the budget is on to the conference committee. Any thoughts, any worries as to how this is going to come out on the other side, especially for your district?
Well, the governor's committed to no new taxes, and that's a good thing, and I support him 100%. Mm. We hope that, you know, his revenues have been a bit soggy, especially as regards state sales tax revenues. We hope they come up. And if not, then the governor will either have a set of vetoes and...
9C cuts?
Let's hope not.
Yeah.
Let's hope not. So we will look at, but I can tell you that the President Rosenberg, Speaker DeLeo of the House, and the Governor Baker have a great working relationship. And they're talking to one another, and I think that they will work through a budget that recognizes the funding limitations. You know, we all hope that we'd have all the money for everything, but that might not be the case.
Okay, we're speaking with State Representative Dave DeCoste, representing the 5th Plymouth District.
5th Plymouth, right? Hanover, Norwell, and Rockland.
Ta-da! There you go. And this is the State House Report. This is what we do on a regular basis to open up the program, give folks an opportunity to hear from their legislators, folks who represent them, elected officials. That's how we try to open up the program here on Monday Night Talk. I see one of our other parties is here. Kerry J. Byrne has entered the building, almost like he's Elvis. He'll be stepping to the microphone in just a couple of moments. Representative, if folks are tuned in, if there's something that they want to reach out to you about, how can they do that?
The easiest way is just to mail me, email me, and it's dfdecoste@gmail.com, mm-hmm. or you can go on to citizensfordecoast.com, and there's a way to email me there. But either way, we respond or call right up to the district, and that's all online.
Okay. So you could take off the guest hat, mm-hmm. put back on the co-host hat.
All right.
We are going to just step aside just for a couple of moments, and when we come back, more Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Peter, it was always Tiny's intention to have a Tiny and Sons business.
That's true. We always worked well together. But my mom had a lot to do with it. I think she wanted us out of the house. She really needed her peace and quiet.
5 kids? You really can't blame her.
Tiny taught us how to get along and work together. And most important, Mother knows best.
Did you learn anything about windshields?
That too, but you really get used to doing a good job. You know Tiny's gonna check it out.
My boys do a good job.
My dad did a great job. 1-888-64-TINYS. Just call.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
All right. Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. And thank you for tuning in. If you miss any segments, don't forget, I do my best to make sure that we put them up as a podcast. You go to our website, 959watd.com. I don't necessarily break it up like I used to. It's kind of the whole show. So you got to kind of scrub through. But usually when I take pictures of my guests, you'll be able to know. You can kind of pick out who was on the show. So, because it's like a little bit of a montage or a collage. Okay. Our next conversation, this is going to be interesting to see what happens. I know that there are folks who are passionate when it comes to sports. I know that the folks who are passionate when it comes to their cultures. And this is kind of, I think, those two kind of meeting. We have joining us on the phone line, Claudia Foxtree. She is a professional educator. She also leads the conversation on Native American identity, culture, and history. Welcome to Monday Night Talk, Claudia.
Thank you for having me.
You got it. Now, I also have Carrie J. Brent. Carrie is from coldhardfootballfacts.com. He is known as the potentate of pigskin. I like saying that. As a writer, somebody who has cultivated that website into its importance these days. Also somebody who writes for a Boston newspaper, The Herald, and is somebody who's also passionate about various issues. And I will tell you, when I saw, I know that last Tuesday, this bill in regards to the ban of Native American mascots in public schools in Massachusetts, that it was heading to a hearing, I had an interest because I had seen Facebook, social media is one of those things that, well, sometimes it's one of those things that you can kind of gauge where there's a conversation going on. Conversation is healthy. And so I thought I would try to bring the two sides together. Kerry is somebody who I saw who seemed more of a proponent of maintaining the use of Native American names and had a position on it. And I also reached out to Linda Thomas, who I believe heads up a group of folks who would like to see this legislation moved forward and passed. If you will, Claudia, kind of give us a little bit of, I don't know if I properly encapsulated your background, but if you could share more about your background and also where your thoughts on this bill.
Sure. I am Native American from the Arawak Nation, and I have five children, and they've gone to public schools. And I am interested in this bill because I'm in a position to be able to think about how my kids are being educated and how their non-Native counterparts are being educated in a school. If I were in a different kind of position, I might be talking about water rights and hunting rights and other kinds of equal access, because there are many, many issues that the indigenous people of this country face. This happens to be an issue as an educator that I am well informed on and therefore supporting.
Okay. Carrie, if you will kind of give your thoughts and position in regards to this bill.
Yeah. By the way, my grandmother was a Mi'kmaq Indian, so I am Native American descent. I didn't grow up in the culture per se, but I'm very proud of my Native American heritage. I think one thing that's lost in this issue, this attempt to ban mascots, to me, and Claudia brought up a very good point, that there's an issue of education. I don't think we're properly educating children about the contributions Native Americans made to our culture. Often it's seen as a white versus, you know, a European versus Native issue, and it's much more complex than that. And one reason I support holding on to these mascots is because they give us a great opportunity to teach our children about the contributions Native Americans have made to our culture. And where I'm from in Quincy, North Quincy High School is known as the Red Raiders. Well, there's a very good reason for that. In North Quincy, in the north end of Wollaston Beach, is a little section called Massachusetts Hummock. It was a seat of the Massachusetts tribe at the time of the European arrival in the 1620s. And this is on the National Register of Historic Places, a very important landmark. Mm-hmm. It's just a short walk to North Quincy High School. And the name North Quincy Red Raiders pays homage to the fact that in this neighborhood of North Quincy was the seat of the Massachusetts Indians, for whom our state gets its name. One of 26 states, by the way, whose names are of Native origin. So I think it's important to hold on to these mascots' names because they give us an opportunity to teach about contributions our natives have made to our culture. And there's a reason why these schools all have these names. There is an important historical reason in almost every instance why these schools have Native names. They're a tribute, and they're not an insult.
Claudia, would you like to counter?
Sure. I don't agree. We have been fighting against mascots almost since they have been initiated. For example, in 1969, Dartmouth College changed its name of the Indians logo and replaced it with Big Green. There's also been plenty of research to show what you think is going to happen, that people will talk more about it, doesn't actually happen. Matika Wilbur researched 5,868 films between 1990 and 2000. 12 included Native American. All showed us a spiritual in tune with nature. 10 showed us as impoverished and beaten down by society, and 10 depicted us in continual conflict with whites.
John Sanchez from the Pennsylvania State University. He did a study between 1990 and 1999 of the big three television stations, ABC, CBS, and NBC. He looked at all networks. It was over 175,000 news reports, and with a combined total of 98 about Native Americans, the majority were of stereotypical 18th century imagery, such as buckskin and riding horses and wearing headdress. It is very, very rare that we are represented in the 21st century. We're not allowed to have our own narrative. We are not brought into a contemporary light. All of the things that you suggest do not happen. And in fact, it is not just the issue of mascots. It's all the associated things with mascots, such as the dressing up, the dancing, which is not our culture, which is not our clothing, and all the mimicry and songs, plus actions like doing tomahawk chops and other kind of warlike things that are not who we are. And so we get trapped in the imagery defined by someone else instead of the one we would want to use for our own people.
Then how come more than 90% of Native Americans support, for example, the name Washington Redskins? This is not really an issue. It's actually, I mean, it may be an issue for you, and I respect that. But for Native Americans at large, this is not an issue. Like you said when you came on, there are much bigger fish to fry in terms of problems facing Native American cultures. And this to me, it seems to me if we want to, and you're right, there, some of these mascot imagery, some of them stereotypes, of course, but that's what mascots are. You know, the fighting Irish, he's a drunk Irish guy with his fist up, ready to fight. I mean, that you could look at it that way too, but the point is it's an opportunity to talk and celebrate Native American culture, and wiping it out, to me, would wipes out from the public, from American history, and wipes out from the cultural lexicon this important, these important contributions Natives have made. It's an opportunity to discuss it. And I think we're on the same page on that part, Claudia, that there are, that we just disagree on. I think maintaining these mascots allow us to discuss these bigger issues, and getting rid of them, to me, wipes Native history from one of the few places where it's given a voice, and that's in some of our public imagery.
Claudia, if I may, this is actually a gentleman who's co-hosting this evening. He's actually a state representative, and a part of his district, they actually utilize a Native American name,
the Hanover Indians.
If you would, Representative, did you want to weigh in or say something?
Well, Claudia, I guess I understand generally what you're trying to accomplish, but my first question that comes to mind is, what business does the state of Massachusetts have in regulating at a local level the names that individual towns are choosing as their mascots? We mentioned, my co-host here mentioned that Quincy is very wedded to their mascot. I know Hanover absolutely is wedded to the Indians. What business should the state of have in moderating or censoring locally determined mascots?
Claudia?
I see this as a civil rights issue, and as with other civil rights cases, it wasn't the school districts and the local level was not making the civil rights decision, as in not integrating their schools or not banning slavery, just to name a few places where the federal government has had to intervene. And I see this as a government leading the way for something that schools are unwilling to do. The so-called pride in Native Americans isn't from the Native Americans, it's from the non-Native Americans appropriating the Native Americans. In fact, this is a case of where it's okay to mimic and pretend, but it's not okay to actually be Native American. And we've had many laws and a long history of not being treated equal in society, not even by the constitutional first, et cetera, amendments. As far as that study with the 90%, that study has many fallacies. It's always the one that's cited. And when you ask people if they would like to have the Native American the mascots changed, they always say yes. It doesn't mean that just because there are bigger issues that this isn't also an issue. And there's plenty of places like the American Psychological Association and a bunch of research that shows the damage of these kinds of images. And it is not equal to the Fighting Irish, which I don't think is great either, but at least Irish people have been represented in a continuum from in a whole range of who they are, whereas Native people have not. So this does not actually promote conversations or appropriate. It just continues the stereotypes which lead to harassment when you're actually in the school.
Claudia, if I could ask, what kind of support is the bill receiving at this particular time?
It's receiving a lot of support from local indigenous tribes and nations in Massachusetts, several Native American organizations that are intertribal, the Massachusetts Teacher Association. Those are the ones that come off the top of my head.
Okay. And it would if your group isn't successful in regards to legislation, is it something that you would approach or the group would approach maybe looking at a ballot question down the road?
It's possible. There are several other avenues, as there has been with other civil rights cases throughout history.
Okay. Matt, did you have a question?
Yes. It's a three-part question, if that's fair to everybody else.
Okay.
Are you, Claudia, against using all indigenous names? The Braintree Wampanoags come to mind, or is it just something like the Dartmouth Indians or the Hanover Indians?
Chieftains, Braves,
Chieftains,
stuff like that.
Yeah. Red Hawks, stuff like that. Second part would be, is there a funding mechanism in place if this bill passes? We're going to need new basketball courts, new turf fields, new uniforms for every school that would have to change their name. And the third part, when you said the Fighting Irish, something like the Boston Celtics, where leprechauns come to mind, is that on par with the same topic that we're discussing?
That's a lot of questions.
Many groups have their own issues. So if there are Irish people that don't want the leprechaun, I'm going to leave it to them. The difference in the issue, though, is that Irish people are represented in their full range of who they are, from the good, bad, ugly, historical contributions, history in general, contemporary images. It's part of our U.S. history classes, and Native people are not represented in the way that Irish are or other groups. And so it is partly an issue of the absence of any accurate information. The other is that...
Claudia, can I interrupt real quick? I agree with you on that 100%. Absolutely. We need to do a better job educating our children, but erasing mascots and nicknames doesn't help to that end. I'm with you right up to that. I'm totally with you. But to me, you're erasing an opportunity to do what you want to have done and what I want to have done, which is do a better job of educating our children about the history and culture of Native peoples. And I don't see how erasing mascots solves that at all. In fact, I think it hurts the end goal that we both have.
Because there is such an absence, the only thing that is put in that void is the stereotypical mascot. That mascot does not make Native people proud. It is entertainment, and it's meant to symbolize a sports team. And I understand that it's difficult to change, but, you know, the New England Patriots did it. Do you know what they were called in 1933?
You're talking about the Boston... you're thinking of the Redskins.
The Boston Redskins.
Yeah, the Boston Braves, and they became the Redskins. Yeah, that was not the Patriots, but yes.
Okay. So...
In fact, I covered the NFL for many years, and I've written a lot about the Redskins' so-called controversy. And let me cite some quotes from you on a story I did. I just pulled them up. These are Native chiefs in Virginia speaking about the Washington Redskins. Kevin Brown, chief of the Pamunkey tribe of Virginia. I don't think there's any intention for Redskins' name to be derogatory. The majority of my people... the people in my tribe don't have a problem with it. Robert Green, chief of the Potawatomi tribe. It doesn't bother me at all. About 98% of my tribe is Redskins fan, and it doesn't offend them either. Ann Richardson, chief of the Rappahannock tribe. I don't have an issue with the Redskins name. There are so many more issues that are important for the tribe than to waste time on what a team is called. We're worried about real things, and I don't consider this a real thing.
Again, you're listening to Monday Night Talk, and we have here in studio, we have Kerry J. Byrne, with coldhardfootballfacts.com, and we have Claudia Foxtree, who is an educator and also leads the conversation on Native American identity, culture, and history. If folks want to find out more, Claudia, in regards to your efforts, is there a website or is there social media for folks to be able to at least get involved and have a conversation about this? Claudia?
I'm thinking of what might be the appropriate source to tell you about. I have a blog about Native American history and culture in general, in a broad sense. For the specific issues, people could email me, and I could see who makes sense to send them to, because unfortunately, we've had to keep our groups private because of the trolling that people have done, and it can be quite scary and dangerous to actually have this conversation as a Native American.
Well, I know when I was speaking, I was going back and forth with Linda. The conversation was about having callers, and we were gonna have yourself and another member call in. Maybe what I'd like to welcome down the road in a couple of weeks, depending on everybody's schedule and what they have in front of them, maybe we have you in studio if your schedule permits it, or another member or two in studio, and we can have a roundtable discussion, a pro and con, so at least it can get the word can get out there, and folks can be better educated on both sides of the issue.
I think that sounds like a potential idea. I just thought of an organization, the Native American Indian Center of Boston, which is known as NACOB.
Mm-hmm.
It's on Huntington Ave. That's an organization that is more involved politically. And UNAC, which is out in AIR, United. Oh, I'm having trouble thinking of their name. But they also do political things, and they also organize the Day of Remembrance that's held every year at on Thanksgiving at Plymouth.
In Plymouth, yeah.
Well, Claudia, we thank you very much for joining us and engaging in the conversation. And I thank Linda and the group for agreeing to at least start the conversation. And hopefully it's something that we can do until there's some kind of resolution and everybody can be happy.
I agree. And that's the United American Indians of New England. And maybe somebody from either of those organizations would also like to join.
That would be fantastic. We thank you. Until the next time we talk, be well.
Thank you, Claudia.
There she is. Claudia Foxtree joining us. Kerry, good conversation back and forth in regards to this issue. Anything you want to say in closing?
No, I think Claudia is very passionate, and she obviously is concerned about the issue. She's right. People don't understand that Natives made incredible contributions to what we considered American culture today. And this, I couldn't even get into all the history behind it, but the one kind of singular example I use is that 26 American states have Native names.
Mm.
That's how important Native culture was. And we named our states after Native people and places. And to me, I agree with her. We don't educate our children, but to erase mascots doesn't help it doesn't help her effort. It only hurts it.
Excellent.
My estimation.
Now you're willing to stay and hang out for more of the program?
Sure, sure.
All right. So we've added another body to the program. We are going to step aside. We're going to exit the first hour of Monday Night Talk. When we come back, Ryan Morrow, right here on Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
The South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Peter, it was always Tiny's intention to have a Tiny and Sons business.
That's true, that's true. We always worked well together, but my mom had a lot to do with it. I think she wanted us out of the house. She really needed her peace and quiet.
5 kids, you really can't blame her.
Tiny taught us how to get along and work together. And most important, Mother knows best.
Did you learn anything about windshields?
That too, but you really get used to doing a good job. You know Tiny's gonna check it out.
My boys do a good job.
My dad did a great job. 1-888-64-TINYS. Just call.
is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, we are back. Great conversation so far, and it's only going to get better. Our next guest is a gentleman who is a national security analyst for the ClarionProject.org. And from what I understand, this organization has actually produced some hit films, Obsession, Third Jihad, and Iranium. And Ryan is a volunteer researcher for the Reform Party of Syria. Ryan, welcome to Monday Night Talk, sir.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
If you would, and I probably didn't do proper justice. I did tease it a little bit as to what your background is earlier. But if you will, kind of give folks kind of a thumbnail of your background when it comes to knowing national security, homeland security, and what we're dealing with when it comes to ISIS and terrorism.
Sure. Basically, my title is Shillman Fellow and National Security Analyst at the Clarion Project, which is a nonprofit that produced the films that you mentioned, mm-hmm. our most recent one being Faith Keepers, about the persecution of Christians and other minorities in the Middle East. I'm also an adjunct professor of Homeland Security or counterterrorism for Liberty University and Regent University, and I got started doing this type of stuff when I was 16, basically being self-taught and just talking to everyone I could in the field to build up my knowledge and my contact, and then just went around from place to place doing various things until working where I do now with the Clarion Project, doing a lot of education of law enforcement and advising of policymakers as well.
Now, what is the International Intelligence Summit?
That was the first big event I spoke at in 2006. Or 2007, I forget which was the first one. And basically at the time, it was the biggest intelligence gathering where you have speakers and brainstorming sessions in the country. So they brought in top experts from every area of the intelligence community possible, foreign policy, together, and somehow I got in there. And that was just really exciting. One of the components of that event that we had the Secular Islam Summit, where it brought together Muslims and former Muslims that were calling for basically an equivalent of the Declaration of Human Rights in the Muslim world. And we think that's what got the attention of Al Jazeera and others, and apparently Osama bin Laden, because he had his Al-Qaeda operatives to get the information on the conference and bring it back to him to read.
How does that make you feel, being somebody? I mean, it's as though you're being studied for what you know about them.
It was really interesting because the government, the U.S. government, was releasing some of the documents that they got from bin Laden's house. I'm looking at it, and one of the documents was the booklet that you get for the International Intelligence Summit, which would have had my bio in it, and that the other speaker. So it's just kind of surreal thinking that that was in bin Laden's home. And it shows, I think, really, that has to come from a place of fear. I mean, maybe they were plotting to attack it. I don't know. We had a lot of security. But it meant that our activity was getting enough global attention, particularly attention in the Muslim world, to get the attention of him. And there's only a certain amount of material that he could request to read when you're in hiding and you have couriers getting it all for you. So he viewed what we were doing as very important.
It just so you know, I'm not alone. I have three other folks who are kind of hanging out this evening. I got Matt. I got Kerry. And I have State Representative Dave DeCoste. So if they'll make sure that they say who they are before they ask you the question, so you know who you're. And I think Kerry wanted to actually ask
Ryan,
a question.
Yeah, Ryan, Kerry Byrne here. How are you? Thank you for coming
on
the show. You mentioned your work discussing, writing about, talking about the persecution of Christians in the Middle East, and it's actually much more profound than that. This is probably the great Holocaust of our time, the systematic wiping out of Christians from the Holy Land and other regions around there. And it really gets no attention. It gets no attention. Is it purely because the media is so far left they don't want to talk about it? They're so anti-Christian they don't want to talk about it. Why is this not an issue? I mean, it's happening right before our very eyes. And you might talk about it, and I applaud your efforts, but this should be on the lead story of national news every night. Why isn't that the case?
I would say look at the first three letters in the word news. it's no longer new.
Yep.
It's been going on for so long that it no longer became something you report on or is worth reporting as something new. And that's what news is based around. And so when you have a genocide going on since 2003 when Saddam fell, it'll get covered for a while, but that's it. And we part of the reason we made the film is because we did internal research that we invested a lot of money into to try to get an idea of how many Christians and specifically pastors understood the issue in terms of scale, how much they connected with the people involved. And we were shocked by the results. It showed that really only a small minority of Christians understood that it's an actual genocide going on there. They tend to view any conflict in the Middle East as being kind of like ethnic or tribal in nature, and they didn't understand that it was, as you described, a Holocaust, and that's what it is. Pastors have more knowledge of it, but they still didn't understand the scale. The scale is unbelievable. Like in 2003, they had about up to, and this is the highest estimate, 1.5 million Christians in Iraq. Now we're down to numbers that could be as low as 200,000. That's how many people have been killed or have been driven out of their homes. It's just unbelievable. That's one country in the Middle East, just one.
I was going to ask: is this our doing in regards to the war in Iraq and Afghanistan? Because we did not plan a proper exit strategy from those two countries, and that maybe the forces in Iraq weren't up to snuff to protect themselves from this. While, you know, Al-Qaeda isn't necessarily the large organization, because we've picked off the heads left and right, that ISIS somehow has risen up from the ashes.
Well, the biggest blame, of course, goes to the forces of radical Islam that have been cultivating this environment for a very, very long time. And even those governments that are not radical Islamic per se, but still promoted the type of extremism and bigotry that leads to this type of thing, responsibility lies ultimately with them. Now, the question of whether some of our actions made things worse, I think undeniably they did, by toppling Saddam and not having part of the strategy, sending in troops into this area where the Christians are, because you can identify where they are. They're not all scattered, and protecting them. In fact, there were some Christians that rose up and fought Saddam when we invaded, but it was with the understanding that they would have their own little autonomous area. They'd still be part of Iraq, but they'd be able to have their own representation, their own security forces, and they'd be protected. And that ultimately did not happen. And as a result, you have this genocide that's going on. It's very disappointing because it was preventable. But it is reversible, though. And if you talk to Christians over there, and I was in Iraq earlier this year, they will emphasize that they believe that as bloody and as horrible as this is, they believe it's reversible, and they could actually have a brighter future in the Middle East than they had under Saddam if the right policies are put into place and they are able to flourish and have a story of revival rather than one of fighting for the last minority to survive.
Not that I would want you to put out a playbook as to what needs to be done to deal with ISIS and any future, because I think the one thing that is on a lot of Americans' minds, we're seeing what's going on over in Europe time and time again. Not only the two things that happened in England recently, but we've seen in Paris, we saw in Belgium, we saw in Germany, where it's not necessarily, you know, explosives, but it could be just, you know, a handful of individuals with some kind of a weapon or a motor vehicle large enough to plow through a heavily populated event. What are we doing right, or what are we not doing right in regards to hoping that that doesn't happen here?
Well, in terms of fighting against ISIS, we are on a positive track, and that positive track has intensified since Trump got in and Mattis got in there as defense secretary, and you're seeing that happen in Raqqa. Now, there's a Christian militia of about 2,000, and they also have a female wing that are involved in the fight for Raqqa, which is the capital of ISIS, of their caliphate. And they're asking for direct U.S. support. These little Christian self-defense forces that are popping up in Iraq and Syria want a direct relationship with the United States. And in the case of the biggest one in Iraq, they've actually had to side with Iran because we weren't in the picture. So I would say immediately we should have a direct relationship with them so that they can just protect their own villages.
But I got to stop you just for half a second. And this is my fear, because it's that thing that we keep doing over and over. And you're talking about these groups that want help from the United States. There was a time when Osama bin Laden was being helped by us when he was fighting Russia. There was a time when we were helping Saddam Hussein when he was fighting Iran. Eventually, it seems as though groups that we help, it ends up that it's the money and the things that the weapons that we give them are eventually our own undoing, where it comes back on us.
Well, that's what happens when you embrace people that hate you and you say they're the lesser of two evils.
Right.
The Christians don't hate you, so it's very different.
Right.
And their fate is tied with you. I would say the same with most of the Kurds as well. And so I wrote an article that said the first thing we've got to do, aside from develop direct relationships with these Christian self-defense forces, which is what they are. They're not militias of conquest that are going to go out and seize territory. It's just they want the ability to protect what remains of their cities. And I've walked through them, and there's not much that remains, but people are moving back. But the first policy recommendation I would have is establishing a safe zone for the Christians, the Yazidis, who ISIS is trying to wipe out. ISIS is trying to wipe out the Christians in most cases, but theoretically, their ideology says they just have to force them to submit to theocracy. The Yazidis and these other minorities, ISIS and terrorists like them, believe in just wiping them out and taking all the women as sex slaves. So we can't forget about them as well. So I would say a safe zone in the small area of Iraq so that the Christians can have their own province, that they can have their own self-representation. It's not civil war. It's not leaving Iraq. And Iraqis, by and large, are okay with that. The Iraqi government has said they'd be all right with a proposal like that. And it's something we've done before on a larger, riskier, more costly scale. So that's an easy move that we could do tomorrow. And then I have other ideas that we can do. But the big one right now is a safe zone for the Christians and Yazidis in Iraq.
Ryan, doesn't this go back? I mean, you mentioned, obviously, the invasion of Iraq, the fall of Saddam Hussein, is what seems to you to be an inflection point, and I agree with that. But this issue goes back to the founding of Islam itself, doesn't it? I mean, their immediate effort was to try to wipe Christians out of the Holy Land and out of Europe. You know, I mean, people look at the Crusades
as... Yeah, the 1,400-year history.
What's that?
Yeah, there's a 1,400-year history of that. What they would push back on is, oh, we weren't trying to wipe out the Christians. We just want them to live as second-class citizens. But regardless, it's a jihad towards Christians that's been going on. And then sometimes there's a lull because the Islamic world's not as strong as it once was. And that's not to say that most Muslims today would want to partake in that. But if you look at the history of Islamic civilization, that's what it is. This is not a unique time period. This is just a repetition of what we've seen in the past.
Again, we're speaking with Ryan Morrow, who is a national security expert. This is a gentleman who is not only consulted various government agencies and policymakers, but has made thousands of appearances on radio, TV, widely published, whether it's the USA Today, Washington Post, and it's a privilege to be able to have Ryan on the program to kind of talk about this. Representative, would you like to ask a question?
Yeah, Ryan, talk a little bit, if you would, about the situation of Christians in not only Syria, but also there's a large, primarily Maronite, but a number of other Christian denominations in Lebanon. What's going on there?
Oh, that's an interesting situation, because the Christian population is dwindling just because of what they have to go through there. But the Christian political leadership has actually allied with Hezbollah, the puppet of Iran, and that's because in the Middle East, those types of flip-flops are expected. There isn't a backlash like you would imagine, and in a parliamentary system, alliances come and go, and so the leaders of the Maronite Christians have actually allied with Hezbollah. If you look at polls of Christians in Lebanon, I forget the percentage. I don't know if it's the majority, but at least a very significant minority have positive feelings towards Hezbollah as a result. But that's what happens when there's no other alternative and they're dependent upon horrible radical actors. That's just what's going to happen if you don't build up competing forces if the U.S. can't be directly involved. The Christians, for instance, in Karakush in Iraq, where I was, the Christian militia there is working with Iran. They don't love Iran, but because they're dependent upon them, if you get them on the record, they're not going to say anything negative. So that is a result I see as of a power vacuum.
Matt?
You mentioned Hezbollah. I'm Jewish, in full disclosure. Been to Israel. It's a very interesting situation over there. Where do you see the whole Gaza Strip situation playing into the greater issue of Islamic terrorism?
Well, Hamas creates a foundation from which ISIS springs. I don't view these groups as being singular entities. They all come from this Islamist foundation, and by Islamists, I mean those Muslims that take their faith and they treat it as a political doctrine, which historically it has been. But there's many Muslims that say that's not what you should be doing. And so for the Muslims that say, no, we believe in the traditional backwards version of Islam, and some would say the authoritative version of Islam that combines mosque and state, that's really the foundation. And Hamas, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, all the groups come from that foundation. So Hamas will condemn Al-Qaeda sometimes. And there's been fights between the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda and Hamas and ISIS elements. But then they also work together. So Hamas is working with ISIS in the Sinai Peninsula now, according to Israeli intelligence. And all of these groups are interconnected. The interesting developments over the past week is how the Arab world has basically kicked Qatar, the small island that's the richest country per capita on Earth, out of the Arab world. I mean, they're still Arab, but basically kicked them out and did a vicious blockade on them because they got sick and tired of their sponsorship of terrorism, including Hamas. So it's really great to see countries that, even if you're critical of them and they do other bad things, it's still great to see countries like Egypt, the UAE, Libya, Saudi Arabia, saying Hamas is an enemy that needs to be destroyed. That moves us in the right direction. Even though Saudi Arabia contributes to the overall problem on that issue, that's a positive for us.
Ryan, I have to ask you, have you been tapped by the Trump administration? Have you heard from anybody from within the cabinet to come and share some of your insight and your knowledge on this matter?
I do brief policymakers and their staff on both sides of the political aisle, and yes, there have been conversations with some people in the administration. Is there some decision that was made that I can say that's due to me? No. I would certainly like to be more involved, and I would say that for any administration. I would say that if Clinton won, because I think that there's behind the heated rhetoric you see on cable news, there's agreement on like 90% of things. And there's room for good ideas from everybody, I think.
So you had nothing to do with the Moab then? The mother of all bombs being dropped.
I wish I could. I really wish I could take credit for that one.
Hey, Ryan, let me ask you.
All I could do is just scream in happiness.
Ryan, it's Kerry Byrne again. I have a friend who, ironically, now works in military intelligence, but 20 years ago, before 9/11, he was always talking about this guy, Osama bin Laden. We need to watch out for this guy. No one had heard of him. I didn't know what he was so worried about. And of course, it turns out my buddy was absolutely correct. This guy was, you know, brought devastation to America and launched this new spasm of violence and, you know, Islamic violence throughout the world. Is there someone out there we should be looking at right now that nobody knows about? Is there somebody on the horizon that nobody's talking about but is really a threat
to us? We don't want to, that could possibly cause another 9/11.
The Osama bin Laden of 1996.
Yeah.
Right, that's a great question because this is the point I try to make even with law enforcement and it falls flat because they're so, FBI and Homeland Security are so tied up trying to fight ISIS and Al-Qaeda, they don't have enough resources that they don't want to hear about these other groups that are doing illegal jihadi activity in the U.S., but if it doesn't involve setting off a bomb on American soil or in Europe, they're just not going to look into it because there's only so much time in the day. Mm-hmm. But my point is, and I think this is a big lesson of history, that you have to look at who is going to be your most likely adversary around the corner. And I think I've said Qatar was going to be it. Turkey, I believe, is going to be a very big one. they pose a bigger long-term threat to us than ISIS.
How so?
I genuinely believe that. Because they're a state sponsor of terrorism. What the Turkish government believes in is not too far removed from ISIS, even though they don't get along with ISIS. They argue over who's to implement Sharia law in a caliphate. But that's a minor argument. And they're a powerhouse. They're an absolute powerhouse. Turkey's a member of NATO. They house an American military base, so we have dependency upon them, which is why we haven't been more aggressive. And they are a theocratic dictatorship now. Already, Turkey is sponsoring political parties in Europe. They are, just like the Saudis did before them, they're sponsoring mosques and trying to spread their ideology around the world. They get a pass because they're supposedly a moderate country. So I would say Qatar and Turkey is what I've been warning about for a long time. I think the pendulum is swinging back to Al-Qaeda, particularly in Syria. They're going to pick up the remnants of ISIS. And they already, Al-Qaeda already has in Syria alone an army of 10 to 20,000. They are allied with various other diet Al-Qaeda groups, I call them. It's a very similar groups to Al-Qaeda in Syria that are powerful that also believe in attacking us.
One other question, group, Ryan. Is Europe lost?
Ooh.
No.
No.
Nope. Europe is not lost. There's been times where I've said that in frustration, but it's not lost. It's still a winnable situation. It's just going to be really bad. It's going to get worse before it gets better, because Europe's at a stage now where they're going to start rolling back some of their democratic freedoms in order to take on the Islamist infrastructure. It's a different environment than the United States, where here someone's holding an anti-American protest saying, you go so far as to say, I side with Al-Qaeda, and that will be allowed. People will protest if you come under investigation for that and you have your rights violated. If the authorities investigate you, and they probably look into you a little bit, they're not going to invest their full resources into you in that hypothetical scenario.
Right.
So Europe, it's different. Europe has shut down hate groups.
Real quick, a representative question.
Well, I was going to have him talk a little bit about the Russian role in Syria in particular. There are some sources that say that Putin has adopted a historic Russian role of protecting Christians and Orthodox Christians in that area. What do you think about that?
Well, several years ago, I wrote an article, and it's really relevant now, where I was watching Russian propaganda and the statements of the Russian government and also comparing that to Soviet-era efforts to influence Christianity and the American right wing. And they had their own efforts to go after the left wing as well, obviously. But I saw a very big strategic change in Russia's messaging, where it was very Tea Party-like. It was clear to me years ago that they felt that there was something going on the right that they could tap into and use it to promote pro-Russian sentiment. And one of the key lines was, America has become so morally decadent and democracy weakens countries that they are not going to be the saviors of the Christians and modern civilization. It's going to be us, the Russians, because we're tougher and our system is different. It's more of a strongman. So some of that's going to be Russian propaganda. But then there are parts that are a little bit truthful, meaning in Syria, when Russia backs Assad, and Assad even has some Christians fighting on behalf of him, you can give Russia some credit for that. Okay. Russia has directly armed a small Christian militia in Syria as well. But if you look at what Russia is doing by backing Iran and Assad, fundamentally, are they making the situation better for the Christians or worse? I would say undoubtedly worse. It's just that after they make it worse, they do a few things to say, oh, we're protecting the Christians so that they don't suffer as much under the scenario that we created.
Matt, quick.
Ryan, it's Matt Nelson. Quick question. You mentioned the Turkish government, the whole situation with Inez Kantner. Does that kind of bring to light, in, at least in the government's eyes, what is that whole situation do for kind of watching out on the horizon for the Turkish government?
Well, Turkey's said that they're going to fast-track sending troops to Qatar, and now Pakistan might be joining them. And as frightening as that is, I just like the fact we're getting clear lines now. We've been operating in the gray area for so long, but now it's becoming clearer and clearer who's on our side and who isn't. And Turkey is on the enemy side. It's just what it is. And the State Department doesn't want to go along with it because the State Department values their performance on getting along with countries and having cooperation. That's what the State Department is for. So they're fundamentally against punishing other countries and doing things that deteriorate relations. But we've got to start sanctioning Turkish officials. We've got to develop a process to kick members out of NATO, including Turkey, because amazingly, such a process does not exist, which is why no country feels obligated to pay their fair share. And we've got to start moving our military assets out of Turkey because we can't be dependent upon them anymore. So one of the other recommendations I have is that the U.S. should fully and completely come swing behind the idea of a Kurdish state. The Kurdish people are very pro-American, even pro-Israel, openly on the street. The daily discourse there, if you talk about politics, is that they want to separate mosque and state and be a model for the region and counter what the Saudis and other countries have done by promoting radicalism. They want to promote a modern version of their faith that's compatible with Western-style democracy. So to me, the best strategic move we can make is get an independent Kurdistan in there, and then we have an alternative to Turkey and an alternative to Qatar, and then they can't hold us by the neck anymore and say, well, you know what, you need us.
Right.
I want to take that argument away.
We got to wrap up the segment, but I actually cut Kerry off and wanted to give him one last question.
Back on the topic of Europe, Ryan, it seemed from what you said, and then we went on down a different path, but do you think there is a political will now among the Western, you know, Western European countries to do what they need to do to prevent the further radicalization of their political structure and, you know, their culture in general?
Among the people, without a doubt, something snapped. After the Manchester attack and the London Bridge attack and then all these riots that go on and are misreported and underreported, something's snapping. And now the question is, are they going to invest their time in measures that are arguably counterproductive, like banning the burqa or taking the hijab out of schools and things like that? Or are they going to actually do substantive things that makes it easier to arrest people, easier to dismantle the Islamist infrastructure and build up alternatives? Because that's what you've got to be doing. And they haven't gotten that right yet.
Ryan, I want to thank you. We're plumb out of time. And we want to thank you. You've been a great guest. We'd love to have you come back on and talk more, especially we know that we're not done with this situation when it comes to terrorism, when it comes to ISIS and what's going on over in Europe. And just so folks want to find out more about what Ryan is doing, what he's working on, Ryan Morrow, MAURO.com is the best way. Or you know what? I saw him not too long ago on Fox News. He's on there on a regular basis. Watch for some of his pieces. Again, Ryan, we can't thank you enough for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You got it. There he is, Ryan Morrow, National Security Analyst, joining us here, guys. We're going to step aside, and when we come back, we're going to throw the gloves, the stick, and we're going to talk to Nesson's Jack Edwards right here on Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
All right, we are back here on Monday Night Talk, the final segment. This is going to be the best segment, and I'll tell you why. A gentleman who is joining us, I earlier equated him, and I hope he accepts this. I see him as kind of like the Johnny Most of hockey here, and you know how passionate Johnny Most was. But he might have a little bit more edge to him. a guy who, when you're watching the game and listening to the call, his call of the game, it's like none other. Who am I talking about? Nesson's Jack Edwards, voice of the Boston Bruins. You can find him on Twitter at Real Jack Edwards, if you will. Now, this, the magnitude of this guest, I had to put together a montage because you got to pay such homage to a guest like this. Larry, roll the best of Jack Edwards.
Blowing call coming here against Chad Rose, and he's just yapping all the way to the box. Oh, it's got to be tempting to give him an extra two for the mouth. But the goal scorer who tied it is going to go and sit and watch the next couple of minutes. It's Michael Ryder, the Bruins, extending themselves to try to defend a one-goal lead late. Hamlet goes down as if shot. Get up! Here comes Cavallari. Montreal trying to nurse ridiculous calls out of the referees. Parcillo takes it down. Jones on the end board. Lucic hammers it. Down goes Jones. And how is this for irony? The crowd wants a call for a hit from behind. That is true. What a game we got going. Lucic mashes Jones. Cry me a river. He's got a breakaway. 3-on-5. Campbell. And he scores. And now an ode to the composite stick. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of all ages, I give you Mr. Jack Edwards. Welcome to Monday Night Talk, sir.
It's good to be with you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Would you like to say hello to Mr. Matt Nelson, who is in studio as co-host?
Yeah, you know, Matt is the reason I still have a job at Nesson. He did all the hard work and also got coffee on time and nice and hot all season long. So, yeah, Matt and I go back quite a ways. He was an outstanding intern at Nesson. He's got a bright future.
Attaboy, Matty. Way to go. Where's my water? Just kidding. I got to start the conversation off with you, Jack. Last night, we see the Pens getting yet another cup. Can you at least weigh in on that to start?
Yeah, you know, I think you got to tip your cap to Mike Sullivan because despite all the talent, you still got to get those guys to play together. You got to get them to buy into a system. You've got to get them to play systematic defense, which involves a lot of sacrifice. They lost so many defensemen and still managed to play great team defense. They shut out Nashville twice in a row to finish off the Stanley Cup. So, you know, tip your cap to the Pens. They certainly had a better Stanley Cup final than the officials did because that was just nightmarish last night. I mean, the reversal of what should have been a goal call because the ref blew the play dead when he had no idea where the puck was, and it was actually loose in the crease after being under Matt Murray's glove for about a tenth of a second. I think that probably stands second in recent Stanley Cup final history, only to the goal that ended up finishing the 1999 Stanley Cup when Dallas scored a goal that shouldn't have counted in overtime in Buffalo in Game 6.
How close are our Boston Bruins to being either Nashville or Pittsburgh in the next year or two?
I think two is realistic. I think that it's going to depend on the following things. They've got to find an authentic top pair left shot defenseman to pair with Charlie McAvoy as McAvoy rapidly ascends to the elite level, presuming that McAvoy is going to have a tremendous rookie year, which I think he's going to. Certainly all the signs are there. He's going to go through slumps. He's going to go through the rookie growing pains. But he has poise. He has stick skills. He has tenacity. And he has the fire in his belly that are all the ingredients you want in a player who really, truly has the potential to be great. And if they can find a legitimate top pair left shot defenseman to go with McAvoy, next season. That drops Chara and Carlo down to the second pair, and that's a pretty good shutdown second pair. And it would also drop Torrey Krug and either Adam McQuaid or Kevin Miller, depending on which guy they lose to Las Vegas, to the third pair. And if that's what you're going with, I'd take my chances with that decor. But, you know, it's awful hard to find a left shot top pair defenseman who's available, who's not going to blow up your salary structure. I mean, we could all pencil Carl Alsner, the unrestricted free agent from Washington, in there. But if they do that, that's just going to screw them up, because they're going to have to top whatever Alsner's making to pay some of the guys when they become unrestricted free agents, such as David Pastrnak, a couple of years from now.
Matty Ice, you get the next question.
Jack, you mentioned Vegas. Everybody's mind,
the Golden
Knights, heart is now on the expansion draft and who the Vegas Knights are going to poach from each team. Every time the conversation comes up, this town shouldn't have a hockey team. They're too warm weather. We saw upwards of 1 million people in downtown Nashville last night. Does that conversation disappear now?
Well, you know, it depends what ownership does with the franchise. If it's a situation like the Phoenix Coyotes, who have been desperate for a buy-in owner who's going to evangelize the sport, then there's going to be trouble. It seems as if Las Vegas has super deep pockets, so that doesn't seem to be on the horizon. On the other hand, you got a Florida team that made the Stanley Cup final in 1996 and has such low television ratings that a couple of seasons ago, if you sent a limousine to the house of every single person watching the game and brought them to the rink, they still would not have filled the place. So, you know, that's a problem. On the other hand, you go across the state to Tampa in a 20,000-plus seat arena. They fill that place every single night. They could sell more tickets than they sell, and they've got a rabid following. And that's because stable ownership went in there and evangelized the sport, connected with the community, made the team an organic part of that town, and now it's hard to imagine a separation between the Bolts and Tampa Bay. If the Vegas Golden Knights can do that in the first 10 years of their existence, we'll have no worries. That'll be a great expansion franchise. But predicting the future, I'm no good at it. So, you know, we'll have to see what they do. They've got the chance. They won the bidding war, and they've got the chance. But now they got to put it up.
What is it about this team, Jack, that, you know, that has kept you here, being the voice of the Bruins for Nesson? If you had to be in Edmonton prior to Peter Chiarelli, do you feel that you'd be able to get up for every game with whoever was doing color with you, or do you feel you have to thrive in a market like Boston?
Well, I've said this before, Kevin, and I'll probably say it many more times before my time comes, but if you grow up in New England and you're a hockey fan, there really isn't an original six. There's an original one. Mm. It never was my dream to call play-by-play for the New York Rangers. I love Chicago. It's an awesome city, but I don't think they'd have me. Montreal, come on now. That's a six joke. And Toronto and Detroit have their own cultures and plenty of homegrown talent to fill those roles. There's something that feels totally at home for me when I call Bruins games. It's my friends listening that I've known my whole life. It's the people I've met along the way, and when I go over the top, they let me know. And if I really screw up and I apologize sincerely, they forgive me and let me continue. So I'm so at home in this job. I really don't want another. I haven't looked for work since 2008, and I'm not going to. I really want to leave this job horizontally.
Amen. Well, I mean, again, we played the clip at the start of the segment. I mean, when you listen to some of the other games around the country, if you listen to, you know, a national broadcast, it doesn't, your timing is impeccable, and usually you know how to encapsulate the situation with a punctuate, you know, with a nice exclamation mark at the end of whatever you're saying. And so I think while some fans may go, oh, what is he doing? There are other fans who are cheering you on because we know that you are somebody who's, you know, you're up in the booth while you're calling the game. You're also cheering on the home team.
Yeah, and, you know, we don't serve vanilla ice cream at our ice cream shop. you know, if you want that, there's plenty of it around in the NHL, and you can find it anywhere on almost any channel that covers hockey. But I think that anybody who really seeks fulfillment in his or her job has to be true to him or herself, and that's who I am. I don't go to a hockey game for careful, dry analysis. I go to a hockey game to get excited. I don't want people falling asleep on the couch. I want them jumping on their coffee tables and screaming and yelling. And I think that's sort of an organic part of being a Bruins fan, to get excited at the game, to have a stake in it emotionally, to have it mean something, even if it's a regular season game in early November. If there's something going on that could affect the entire season, or if there's a brilliant play for or against the Bruins, that ought to be exciting. That ought to be one of the most interesting things that happens to you all day long. And if we can make people forget for just a second that they're actually sitting on their couches and that they think they're at TD Garden or some other far-flung arena in the NHL, then we're doing our job. And that's why we get excited. That's why Rick and I laugh so much, because we're getting paid to do a fantasy job, and if we can have people along enjoying it with us, then all the better.
Okay, we're speaking with Nesson's Jack Edwards, voice of the Boston Bruins. Find him on Twitter at RealJackEdwards. Now, don't we have someone down in D.C. who uses the real part? Is this like the chicken or the egg? Was the at RealJackEdwards first, or was the at Donald Trump first?
I don't know.
It's a rhetorical question.
I was so new to Twitter a few years ago. Somebody asked me the question, do you like One Direction? And I said, yeah, North. So, you know, I'm not real smooth with social media, and I'm still sort of getting used to it. Matt used to look over my shoulder and laugh at how I would struggle with it, but It's an odd thing, isn't it?
it is, you know, trying to get everything down in 140 characters. I'm still struggling, so I'm with you. We have in studio one of our state reps here on the South Shore, Dave DeCoste, who actually wants to ask a question.
Jack, you're doing great job at Nesson. You've risen to the top of your profession, doing very well. Do you have any comments on what's become of the demise of ESPN and the problems they're having? You seem to be able to make things work. What's going on with ESPN?
Well, first of all, I haven't worked at ESPN since 2003, so I'm pretty distant from it, yet I still live about 45 minutes drive from Bristol, and I have a lot of associates and friends who still work there and have worked there through the years, so I've got sort of a secondhand understanding of what's going on. There was a culture change at ESPN when Disney bought Cap Cities, which was the parent company of ESPN, in the summer of 1995. And when that happened, it went from sort of a cult that celebrated its cult status to being really mainstream and seeking the most fannies sitting in front of the TV that it possibly could. So efforts to let me start that thought over. When I started at SportsCenter in 1991, and I worked SportsCenter from 91 to 99 before I started doing full-time play-by-play, the unofficial motto in the newsroom was serious sports news for serious sports fans. And I've never known a serious sports fan who didn't like a good belly laugh. So in the course of a half-hour SportsCenter, there were always a couple of moments where you'd get a chuckle in, but you weren't swinging for the downs on every single pitch. You know, you weren't trying to hit a home run when really what your team needed was a sacrifice bunt, just move the runner into scoring position. there was that sense that you would get your chance to establish your individuality, yet at the same time, you were talking to a very small audience that knew an awful lot about sports, and you weren't going for just the slam dunk and the three-point shot and the home run and the strikeout. You were going for the thing that you noticed and that your production team noticed that maybe nobody else in the whole world of sports media noticed. And that's what made SportsCenter so interesting. When Disney took over in 1995, it became formulaic. There literally was, and I believe still is, a survey circulated each week that tells people who are putting the shows together not what is the most interesting thing to the most people, but the thing that will cause the most people to tune out. So it's sort of producing not to lose instead of producing to win. And to me, that was the worldview change that occurred when Disney took over the company, and it became totally a profit-driven system. And the irony of it is that although it wasn't a totally profit-driven system before that, it was basically a philosophical statement about how sports should be done on television, it became so unbelievably profitable that it became one of those things that Disney said, well, it doesn't matter how much it costs, we're going to buy it because we got to have those profits in our company instead of somebody else.
Let's get back to talking a little Boston Bruins hockey here. We know that in just a couple of days, well, it's a little bit more than a couple of days, we've got the NHL draft. We got the expansion draft. Any kind of ideas as to what the Bruins might do? I mean, where they might want to go with the draft picks, or as far as who they might lose? Who might they lose?
Yeah, well, let's start with the draft choices, because the priorities for this team clearly are to get a left wing who can make David Krejci shine. Maybe that's Anders Bjork, the star from Notre Dame who passes up his senior season in college to try to make the Bruins right out of Notre Dame. If he can do that, if he can be an impact player as a rookie, that would be a wonderful development. Most observers are kind of skeptical that he can make the jump from being an outstanding college player to being an outstanding NHL player. And you've got to be an outstanding player if you're going to be a top six forward on David Krejci's line. You got to score a lot of goals, and that's one of the hardest things to do in all of sport. So I think the Bruins are still looking for somebody who would fit that bill. Don Sweeney has said that his mid-first round draft choice is in play if somebody wants to make the right offer. But again, championships are won with defensive cores. That's why Nashville got as far as it did, despite losing Ryan Johansson in the playoffs. That's why Pittsburgh was able to win, because they beefed up their D after Chris Letang went down and didn't even play a minute during the playoffs, because they had so much depth of guys who would buy into the system and play through it and do the right thing. That's what the Bruins need. So even though the Anders Bjork and left wing for Krejci thing is a priority, I would say that the top priority is finding that legitimate first pair left shot defenseman who's going to complement Charlie McAvoy for the next 3 to 5 years as this team reopens the Stanley Cup window. If they can do that, I think the Stanley Cup window reopens in 2018-2019. I see 2018, the coming season, as being akin to what Toronto just had in this past season, a young team, yep, an exciting team, a team that clearly has a fantastic future and a lot of potential of players who are arriving right now. And they showed the league they needed to be taken seriously by everybody. And this year, Toronto is going to be able to contend if they can play to that potential and continue to grow. I think the Bruins are just 1 year behind them.
See, I'm kind of bummed out because I used to like the beatings that the Bruins put on Toronto. So I just liked it. It was usually a W that you could count on. But last year, it was tough. Matt?
Jack, as you and I well know, timing is everything in the sport of hockey.
the first episode of Nesson's new weekly summer show.
Yeah.
Bruins Summer Faceoff Live is the day after the expansion draft in the NHL Awards. Tell us about the show.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to get into it. This is part of the beauty of working the Bruins for Nesson is that there's an arm's length relationship with ownership. As everybody knows, the Red Sox own 80% of Nesson and the Bruins own 20% of Nesson. Yet I've never been told what to say on the air, and I've never been scolded for anything I have said on the air. So I think what you're going to hear is a frank discussion of the state of the Bruins, where they're going to stand and what their future looks like. And this is going to be a fun summer, because no matter what Don Sweeney does, you know he's going to stick to his plan, and we're going to see how it's going to evolve. The moves he's able to make or the moves he chooses not to make, because the price to make those moves is too steep. Personally, I'm looking forward to it. I think we're able to voice our opinions as well as they're well informed, and our whole staff does our best to be that way. So, yeah, bring it.
So does that mean you don't get a vacation? You don't get any time off? No R&R?
Listen, I wish that my vacation had started last night with my hair soaked with champagne. But, I have a lot of downtime during the off season, and that's okay. But at the same time, I probably spend an average of anywhere from 2 to 4 hours a day every day during the off season, working on my charts and doing research and finding out little nuggets about players that I've been studying for 8 or 9 years that I learned something new about because I go a little bit deeper. So there's about a 1-3% chance that kind of information ends up on the air next season, because hockey moves so fast, you got to keep track of the puck. But every once in a while, some little nugget that I learned in July ends up spilling out of my mouth in February. So it makes all the off-season research worth it.
So you're going to be trying to pile them up on the new head coach, no longer interim, Bruce Cassidy then, huh?
Yeah, you know, Bruce is he's such a likable guy. He's so humble. He wants it so bad. He spent so much time in head coaching limbo after getting a chance with Washington way back at the turn of the century, and then working his way back through the AHL, and the good job he did, especially with player development in Providence. And he took all the good things that Claude Julien had put in place, and he injected a new energy and a slightly different way of looking at things, especially in the front half of the ice. And he was just the right voice for this roster at this time. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what he can do when he's got a full training camp. And I'm really, really looking forward to the first time the Bruins play Montreal, because no matter what happens in that game, that's going to be some capital D drama.
Well, Jack, we want to thank you so much for joining us. So hopefully down the road we can have you back on, maybe before the start of the season, and get a little insight. But we're very happy to have had you on here to kind of talk to the fans here on the South Shore. Anything you want to say to them who are listening right now?
Yeah, you know, I appreciate so much the level of understanding of the game in New England. Throughout the Stanley Cup playoffs, we heard so many explanations of basic rules, and you understand why network announcers have to do that. Occasionally we had to do that on ESPN, but it's so great to work in front of a knowledgeable audience, because the tribe that follows this Bruins team understands the game. They know the history of the team. We can make strange, minute references, and people react to those references because they've known the history of the team, because their moms and dads knew the history of the team, and their grandmothers and grandfathers knew the history of the team. And that's just a beautiful thing. It makes our jobs a dream come true for Brick and me.
Well, Jack, we thank you so much. You have a great couple of days off until the kickoff of the Bruins Summer Faceoff, which is Thursday, June 22nd at 6 p.m. Until next time, my friend, have yourself a great evening.
Thanks, Kevin.
You got it. There he is. Nesson's Jack Edwards, voice of the Boston Bruins. Check him out on Twitter. Go easy on him. at Real Jack Edwards. Maddie, nice job this evening. You've earned your stripe. You can come back. Representative DeCoste, thank you for being here as well.
Great being here. Thank you for having me.
That's all the time we have until next week at 6:15. Have a great evening.
South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. 95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.